quarter. Okay, great. Now, I hope to get through about chapter 16 or 17 today. We'll see. I want to get at least two-thirds of the way through Abraham's story. So next week, we could finish up Abraham, do Isaac, and maybe just barely start Jacob. And then the last week, we'll do Jacob and Joseph. All right, so Genesis 12, 10 through 20. This is not exactly a victory lap for Abraham. But there's famine in the land. And, you know, when there's famine, sometimes we're tempted to go down to Egypt. You know what I'm saying? There's some dry times. And we're tempted to go off into Egypt. And Abraham goes down there and he's worried. I mean, God had already said, I'm going to give you this land. And your children are going to be like the stars of the sky, and kings are going to come from you. But Abraham decides to use logic. By the way, logic's a good thing. In fact, there's nothing to be gained from doing illogical things generally, all right? Except certain illogical things, like believing God's going to bring you to heaven when you die. But, behaving irrationally is not a good thing. So Abraham says, all right, now, I'm not going to be in the promised land, so God can't take care of me. I'm going to be in Egypt, so I got to do a plan. So I'm going to help. I mean, I know God's plan is for me to have, children, but I have to he's kind of helping God's plan along. He's kind of, using his little humanistic logic, which is God can't really help me out in Egypt. And, my wife is beautiful. She's 65 years old, but apparently she was beautiful. I mean, she was beautiful. All right. And awesome for her, because everybody said, wow, she's so beautiful. And he realized people are going to be jealous. So he says to her, look, Sarai, when you get there, tell them you're my sister. By the way, it turns out she was his sister. She was his half-sister. She was. Where's the verse that tells you that? I don't know if it's in here somewhere. It's in my notes somewhere, but I can't remember where it is. But she was his half-sister. So, it was a half-truth. He didn't say, she's not married to me. He just didn't say, she's married to me. So are we going to let Abraham off the hook on this one? No. Is God going to let him off on the hook? Well, actually, yes. Yeah. Yeah. God actually lets him off the hook. Because God is gracious. Praise the Lord. All right, but we're not going to let him off the hook. We're not going to give him an excuse, nor should we. But I'm sure he justified to himself, well, she is my sister, half-sister, but sister. All right, and, so he goes down to Egypt. And, one of the stories, one of the plot lines to keep in mind, those who bless Abraham will be blessed, and those who curse Abraham will be cursed. Yes?
Genesis 20:12.
Thank you. It was in my notes, but thank you. Genesis 20, verse 12. Awesome. All right. And so there, who was the parent involved here? Was it? It was Haran or one of these guys. I guess it doesn't matter. So he married his half-sister. So he goes down there. I'm not going to read this story. I'm going to assume, fairly often in Genesis, we're not going to read the whole story. I'm going to assume you know it. If not, you have to go back and read it later. But he goes down there, and I don't think he thought that Pharaoh would want to marry his wife. It's kind of like, when you tell a little lie and it kind of starts steamrolling, but you're already caught up in the lie, so you can't admit it that you said a lie. You know how that goes? Pedro, you don't know how that goes? Really? Wow. You're amazing. Yeah. I remember a time when I was a kid, I was smoking a cigarette and I put it in my pocket because some adults came by and it lit my coat on fire and stuff like that. And so I didn't want to admit that. So I took a pair of scissors and I cut it out. And when I went home, I said that the these friends, their dog had bitten my coat. Well, duh. I mean, it didn't, you know, come on, as if they were that stupid, you know. And so my mom said, are you sure? Oh, yeah, that's the dog. You know that dog, how that dog's always doing that kind of stuff. So then she said, oh, I'm going to call the parents. Anyway, that's what happened to Abraham. All right, let's go to Genesis 12, 19 and 20. Yeah, but apparently Pedro never did that kind of stuff. Pedro, you're amazing. You're amazing. Genesis 12. Let me start in verse 17 to kind of see how it went here. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his house because of Abraham's wife Sarah. This doesn't really even seem fair. Because was Pharaoh sinning? The answer is yes, he was sinning. He was committing adultery. But the difference is, it was not willful sin. Whereas with Sarah and Abraham, it was willful sin. All right, but God said, you know, I'm going to bless you. And those you bless, I'll bless. And so God brought curses. We don't know where those curses were, you know, something. But Pharaoh had a lot of faith. Pharaoh figured it out. Pharaoh seems like Pharaoh had more faith than Abraham here. Seriously. Because Pharaoh figured out that the curses coming on him had something to do with Abraham. Maybe he added 1 plus 1 and got 2. I'm not sure. I don't know. So he says, so Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? He said, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister? So that I took her to be my wife. Now then, here is your wife, and I'm going to kill you both for lying to me. That's not what he did. It's amazing. Take her and go. Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. And Abram actually got more wealthy in Egypt than he had been before. God is blessing Abraham. You think Abraham would start to get it. You know what I'm saying? God has blessed us. And we're still complaining. We're still doubting. Because the blessing he gave us, we're kind of used to it anymore. We kind of take the church for granted. We take the security, we have, you know, these answer prayers for granted. But Pharaoh had enough faith to realize that God was blessing Abraham. And if God's blessing Abraham, I'm going to get on that train. So Pharaoh blesses Abraham. He says, you know, get out of here and don't come back, essentially. So that's that episode. There was a number of episodes. Next is the episode with Abraham and Lot. And this is supposed to be Abraham and Lot looking over the promised land from there in Bethel. They went back to Negev, and then they went to Bethel there. All right, let's read Genesis 13, 8 through 13. I'm going to assume you know the story. Basically, what happened here is they're in the mountain, in the hill country. And in the hill country, you can't really farm. All you can really do is graze your herds. And apparently, Abraham and Lot had fairly large herds. So they're running out of grazing land, and they're realizing we can't share it. So let's see what happens. Genesis 13, verses 8 through 13. So Abram said to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between your herders and mine, for we are close relatives. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Lot looked around and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan towards Zoar was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, if you were to go to the area of the Dead Sea today and looked around, would you say it's well watered like the whole plain of the Jordan towards Zoar? No, you wouldn't. But archaeologists have gone there, and they found between 2500 and 2000 BC, there, although it was fairly dry even then, there were a number of wadis, these streams, they dry up now, but they apparently went all year. And there was significant irrigation. And it's kind of like going into the Imperial Valley. You go into the Imperial Valley, should it be green there? No, but it is. It was kind of like that. So they're up, it's kind of like you're up on the hill on Route 8, and you're looking down, and you see all that green stuff, you're going, I'm going down there. That's kind of what Lot did. So Lot went by sight. Abraham went by faith, and Lot went by sight. And that's a big problem for Lot. Lot lived by sight, and he went to Sodom. It says in verse 10, Lot looked around. All right, he looked around. He's looking at the world. He's thinking through worldly eyes. And he's looking at the world saying, who in the world is kind of, it's working out for them? What are they doing that's working out for them? All right, I'm going to do what they're doing. But those aren't the eyes we look through because we're strangers in a strange land. And our home is not this world. So we're acting like Abraham. And look what Abraham said. This is before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain. And here you go, chose for himself. Abraham says, take it. You can have the better stuff. It's okay with me. Now, he's the uncle, and Lot is the little pipsqueak. And the natural order of things is Lot gets the leftovers, and Abraham gets the good stuff. But Abraham says, you can have the good stuff, because that's the worldly stuff. God said, this is my land. By the way, technically, Sodom and Gomorrah are not in the promised land. They're on the other side of the Dead Sea, which is not even part of the promised land. So Lot makes a fateful but very bad decision. Notice this. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived amongst the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Notice that. He pitched his tents near Sodom. He realizes that's a really worldly place. I kind of like the nice stuff they have, but I can't live with them. So I'm going to live near them. I'm not going to be in the world. I'm going to be like the world as much as I can. But I'm not going to join the world. Well, guess what happens by Genesis chapter 19? Guess where he's living? In Lot. You see the pattern there? Can we learn from that? Do you think it's an accident that this happened? No, this is telling us about reality here. I hope that's not my cell phone. Oh, my goodness.
All right. Phones on silent.
Good, I did, yes. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, look around. I love, this is a great passage. This is a great passage. It says, look around from where you are, to the north, to the south, to the east, and the west. All the land you see, I will give you and your offspring forever. He's talking about heaven. He's asking you to look at heaven. Yeah, it probably should be on silent, if you don't mind. Thank you. All right, he's looking at heaven. Bottom line is, Abraham chose to believe the promise and to reject the world. And God says, well, here, let me tell you about that, all right? Look, everything is as far as you can see. This is going to be your land. And your offspring will be like the dust of the earth. So if anyone could count the dust, your offspring could be counted. And I love this. He says, go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I'm giving it to you. So Abraham went to live near the great tree of Mamre at Hebron, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar to the Lord. So God says to us, you know, you've got to think spiritually. You have to have spiritual eyes. You know, no eye has seen nor mind conceived what God has prepared for those who love Him. We have to have eyes like Abraham.
John, the altar, is that the altar? The altar?
He built several altars.
Where did he get the idea to build an altar?
We don't see a command to do that. It was basically, anybody who worshipped any god built an altar. Whether it was the command to do that or not, I don't really know. The evidence is he built the altar, but he didn't offer sacrifices in the altar like the other people did. It's kind of like to represent his worship. So he wasn't burning animals or killing things on these altars, as far as we know. So it's kind of like for us having a prayer, a place he went to pray, kind of thing. I don't know if he was commanded to build these altars. I know that he did. Wherever he went, he built an altar to the Lord as for him as a visible means to represent his worship of the Lord. I honestly don't know. Maybe James could help me out here, but as far as I know, it wasn't commanded. All right. So I love this passage. Go walk through the length and breadth of the land I'm giving it to you. And I want to encourage you to do kind of a spiritual walk. What can you see God giving you by faith? In heaven, yes. But even in this life, what can you envision God giving you? What does the eyes of faith tell you that God could do in and through your life? And that's what God did for Abraham. And I have to say, it's pretty incredible. Anyway, then there's the story of God saving Lot, because Lot goes down. He's not in Sodom yet. He's near it. And, you know, but he's caught up in the world. And when you get caught up in the world, just bad stuff starts happening. What can you say? So this guy, Chedorlaomer, comes around. He can read the story. And he comes through and he wipes out some cities. And he kind of conquers the cities. And he asks them to tells them to pay tribute. And they're serving him for 10 or 12 years. I can't remember. And then they say, forget you. We're not going to pay the tribute anymore. So Chedorlaomer comes back with his army. And he wipes out the area. And then this time he says, forget giving them tribute. I'm just going to take all your stuff and your slaves. And he took Lot and his wife, and he took them as booty. All right. And by the way, Genesis 14, look at this, verse 12. Notice, Genesis 14, verse 12. They also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living, notice that, in Sodom. It didn't take long. Once you kind of say, the world, yes. Jesus, yes. The world, yes. Kind of, yes. You know, friendship with the world is hatred towards God. If you have friendship with the world, soon enough you're going to be full-blown in the world. You don't stay on that fence for very long. All right? Contrasting, look at the faith of Abraham on the other hand. So what happens is Abraham goes out. He musters apparently he is really wealthy at this time, because he has 300-something soldiers. That's a lot of soldiers. And he goes out. I don't think he conquered the entire army of Chedorlaomer. I don't think that's what happened. I think what he did was he raided the part of the army that had all the possessions, basically. All right, I don't really know that, but that's my speculation, that he could not have defeated this entire army of this huge emperor. But the raiding party that had taken the stuff, and he got the stuff back, kind of like what David did later on, right? Well, let's see his faithful attitude about that, verse 22 through 24. So Genesis 14, 22 through 24. Let me see. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, with raised hand, I have sworn an oath to the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal. That's how much Abraham is going to take from the world. He looks at the stuff of the world, he says, not even the strap of a sandal. Wow! That's awesome! The opposite of Lot, huh? The total opposite of Lot. I'll accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal. So you will never be able to say, I made Abraham rich. I'll accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me to Aner, Eshcol, Mamre. Let them have their share. Okay, great. So I think if we could follow the example of Abraham here, we'd be doing great. All right, Abraham saves Lot. Lot was living near Sodom in chapter 13. Now he's living in Sodom. And I love Genesis. Just highlight this one in your Bible. This is a great one. Genesis 14, 22 through 24. I'll accept nothing belonging to the world. By the way, Sodom did not bless Abraham. And what was said in chapter 12? Those who bless you, I will bless. And those who curse you, I will curse. Uh-oh. Not so good for Sodom. After the king of Sodom basically treated Abraham very rudely and didn't bless him, you know, whatever, it didn't go so well for Sodom. All right, Melchizedek. Melchizedek. Now, what's it, three verses here? Verse 18, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of the Most High God. This El Elyon was who he worshipped. And he blessed Abraham, saying, blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God the Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. And Melchizedek is a prefigure of the Messiah in so many ways. For example, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. That's kind of awesome. He was also the king of Salem. And Salem, the Hebrew word is shalom. So he was the king of peace. He was literally, that's sort of cool. He was literally the king of peace. I like that one. He was the king of Jerusalem. And, you know, Jesus is the king of spiritual Jerusalem, whereas Melchizedek is the king of physical Jerusalem. Back then it was Salem. For some reason it became Jerusalem. In Hebrews 3, Hebrews 7, verse 3, it says, without genealogy, without end of days. Now, I think he did have parents. The Hebrew writer is kind of stretching it, in my opinion. It's like, seriously, I would not have the nerve to make that analogy. But because we don't know who his parents were, and we don't know anything about his descendants, he says that's like Jesus. All right? I don't know. I wouldn't have made that parallel, but all right, great. Without beginning of days, without descendants, a high priest because of his character, not by descent. That point is made in Hebrews. In other words, he was a high priest, not because he was a son of Levi. He was a high priest because of his awesome character of worshiping the same God that Abraham worshiped. By the way, Abraham was not the only person who worshiped God. There were other worshipers of God. I mean, how about Job? Where does he fit in? I don't know. He's not Jewish, that's for sure. All right? So he's a high priest by character. He was greater than Abraham. He's greater than Abraham politically. In other words, Abraham was living more or less in his territory. If you look where Bethel is, you'll realize that Bethel probably was under the lordship or suzerainty of Melchizedek. And so that's part of the reason why Abraham gives a tenth to Melchizedek. Because Melchizedek is his boss, basically. All right, and so, but the Hebrew writer does something that's a little crazy to me. He says, because Levi is still in the loins of Abraham, symbolically, when Abraham makes a sacrifice to Melchizedek, what it's saying is the priesthood of Levi is much inferior to the priesthood of Melchizedek. And in Psalm 110, it says that Jesus, the Messiah, is a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So he's greater than Abraham. It says that. John 8:58-58 talks about that. Also, he blessed Abraham. As God blessed Abraham, as Jesus blessed Abraham. All right? He gave Abraham bread and wine. Whether that should be taken as a prefigure of the Lord's Supper, I'll just throw it out there. He was not a Levite. All priests were Levites, except Jesus and Abraham. Because Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek. Also, he was both a priest and a king. No priest in Israel was ever a king, and no king in Israel was ever a priest. But Jesus is a priest and a king, and Melchizedek is a priest and a king. And it says he's a priest forever of the order of Melchizedek. So that's the awesome parallels between Jesus and Melchizedek. Nice stuff. I'm going to go on to Genesis 15, though. No, I don't think so. No. But he's used as a symbol of God in the flesh. He is. But so are a lot of people. So's Isaac in one case. So is Moses. So is Joseph. Now, but it is true. Melchizedek is fairly mysterious. Could it be that he was taken away as Esau was? Maybe. I don't know. It's possible. It does say no descendants. Is that literally true? I think it's fairly likely it's literally true. He had no descendants. I don't know that for a fact, though. We just have to settle for not knowing and just admitting we don't know. All right?
Do we know what that word means or anything?
What word?
Melchizedek?
Yeah, it means king of righteousness.
King of righteousness.
And Jesus is the king of righteousness, as he is the king of peace. So the analogies, I think, are unmistakable. And the psalm writer makes him a prefigure of the Messiah. And the Hebrew writer sort of brings that home, to say the least. So that's sort of awesome. Okay, great. Now we're in Genesis 15. All right, Genesis 15. Now, Abraham's having one of his bad moments. By the way, his name is still Abram. If I say Abraham, whatever, you know, I'm going to get that wrong lots of times. Then after this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. Now, why is God saying not to be afraid? Because he's been afraid. All right, he's been afraid. All right. I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, oh, sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, you have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir. So Abraham's struggling. It's like, you gave me this promise. It's been quite a few years, and I'm seeing nothing. It's not like Sarah's getting younger. Now, Abraham is about to do for the second time what he did in Egypt. He's about to use his noggin, his brain, his intellect, to decide what God's plan is. And by the way, that's not always bad. On Mount Moriah, Abraham did that, and it kind of worked out, actually. He's about to say, well, Sarah by this time was in her upper 80s. He's saying, that ship went home, that door is closed, whatever. So but it wasn't his idea. It was actually Sarah's idea. Sarai said, and by the way, there is a law in Acadia. The law was that if a woman is infertile, she can give one of her slaves to the husband, and then the children of that slave become her children and official heirs. So this was, you could think of Sarai as being unselfish or being selfish, probably both. Well, I mean, a slave by definition.
I think of the way we enslave the African-American culture.
Well, I would say slavery in America was about the worst form of slavery in history.
Okay.
Slavery has been endemic to human culture throughout time. Different periods of history, slavery was significantly worse, in quotes, than other times in history. Even the Jews had slaves, but God gave very, very specific instructions, which is not slave for life, by the way. You became free eventually. And they could not abuse them, and they had to let them worship along with them, and all kinds of... I would say... I don't really know, but I would say probably the slaves... I get the sense the slaves at this time were not nearly treated anywhere near as horribly as the slaves were treated, the African-American slaves were treated by America. I'm not sure it's the worst treatment of slavery in history, but it's certainly one of the worst. Okay? So, yeah.
Yeah, Spanish were worse.
I'm not going to get into that debate. Well, okay, fine.
They're tyrants.
All right, we'll see. All right. Anyway... Now, surprisingly, God is not angry at Abram. I would have been. But God's made a promise, and I think God understands that Abram does have faith, you know? Abram does have faith. He's been living in a tent the whole time. And even the bad plan with Ishmael, from Abraham's perspective, that was an act of faith. Now, we look at that and we say that was not an act of faith. But probably Abraham convinced himself that that was a faithful thing to do.
So is that how you reconcile the whole Hebrews
Well, I mean, I would not take he didn't waver in his faith literally. I mean, I'm sure the Hebrew writer was aware that he wavered in his faith. But I would say probably the Hebrew writer has Genesis 22 in mind. I would say the Hebrew writer sees Abraham towards the end of his life. And towards the end of his life, he did not waver in his faith. The rubber met the road on Mount Moriah, right? I don't know literally, but yeah. All right, and so I would say the Hebrew writer may be looking at Mount Moriah, all right, and maybe giving him credit. But no, he clearly wavered in his faith. There's no doubt about it. That's a good question. But if you take the statement of Hebrews to apply literally throughout his life, I'm sure the Hebrew writer knew that it wouldn't apply. So I think we should try to understand what he meant by that. So anyway, I think it's worth reading Romans chapter 4 in light of Genesis 15. You know, where it says he's the father of all who are saved by faith. And so maybe to measure it so that maybe you wouldn't become so discouraged, you know, so discouraged. Because, you know, even I've been kind of presenting a pretty high bar here, which I think the Bible is asking me to present. But don't forget the flip side, which is God was patient with Abraham, who was really, really, really trying to have faith. But, you know, and so Abraham needed some encouragement, so God reminds him of the promises. All right? You're going to have a son. Your descendants are going to be like the stars of the sky. In chapter 13, he said they're going to be like the dust of the earth. Now he says they're going to be like the stars of the sky. And he says, I will give you this land. He reminds him of all these things because Abraham needs a little bit of encouragement. But I love Genesis 15:6. I would argue, to me, this might be the key passage in the book of Genesis. And certainly the writer of Romans saw it that way. So let's just take a little bit of time digging, burrowing down. And thank you for reminding us of Hebrews 11 here in this context. Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed the Lord and was credited to him as righteousness. That is encouraging. In fact, that is the gospel message. That is it. I mean, let's throw Jesus in there, you know, the kind of the whole thing that kind of makes it work. All right? But Abraham believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. By the way, what did Abraham believe? I mean, let's be specific here. Yeah.
I think he was believing him, the promises.
Right. Right. Just read it. He believed this. Abraham believed God's promises. Is that the full definition of faith? I don't know, but that's a pretty good definition of faith. Is believing the promises. Believing it in a way where you act. That belief leads to action based on that belief. And so, do you believe God's promises? Abraham believed God's promises. Romans 4, verse 3. And that's the principal argument of the writer of Romans is this. Abraham believed and it was credited to him as righteousness. Before he was even circumcised, he believed. In Romans chapter 1, it says, those who through faith are righteous will live. Those who through faith are righteous will live. The promise is that we will live. And if we simply believe it and really believe it, as Abraham believed it, as James reminded us how Abraham believed it, then we will live. So that's a key passage. And then there's this bizarre scene. I'm sorry, but this is nothing short of a bizarre scene. Are you having back troubles too? It's going through the whole church, man. I'm telling you. I got a chiropractor recommended for you, all right? He lives down the street from us. All right, great. All right, anyway. So then this encouragement was not enough. God needs to encourage Abraham even more. So he has this weird thing with the animals. That's weird stuff. But let's read it. All right. Let me see. So, hey, I'm going to give you these things. Abraham believes, it's credit to righteousness. And then God says, all right, take some animals and cut them in half down the middle and lay them opposite each other. This is an interesting thing. Let me see. So the Lord said to him, bring me a heifer, a goat, a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. Abraham brought all three to him, cut them in two, arranged the two halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. The birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abraham drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation that they serve as slaves. Afterward, they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. When the sun set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, to your descendants, I will give this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaites, Amorites, Canaanites, and Girgashites. Oh, and the Jebusites also. All right, now, this is interesting because apparently this was a kind of sacrifice that was well understood in the people back then. Basically, when you made a covenant, when you made a contract, what they would do is they would kill these animals, split them, and the two of you would walk between the halves of the animals together. And basically, if you broke the contract, what happened to the animal is what would happen to you. That's kind of the deal. Pretty intense. But who walks between the animals in this case? God. Only God. Abraham didn't even have to. Talk about grace. And you know, talk about Jesus dying for our sins. All right? And again, probably you or I read that story and go, that's a weird story. But for Abraham, this was awesome stuff. This was great. This was very strong assurance. However,
does that symbolize Jesus?
I don't know. That might be a bit of a stretch. It might be a bit of a stretch. Right, right. God makes the covenant, and he provides the sacrifice for the covenant, yes. So he's making a covenant with Abraham here. He's going to do it again with the whole circumcision thing in chapter 16 or 17. Yes. So I haven't thought about it carefully. So I'd say probably could analyze this thing and say, yes, this is a clear prefigure of the sacrifice of Jesus. I just haven't thought about it carefully enough. Yes.
The reason why he chose to do a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch?
To represent the God of, I don't know, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. I don't know, really. I've not spent a lot of time in this, to be honest with you. I could probably spend another hour or two looking at it and thinking about it and kind of seeing some of the significance here. Yes?
I've got one other quick question. When he tells them, surely for 400 years your descendants will be strangers, is he basically telling them what's going to happen?
Right, he's prophesying going down to Egypt.
Wow.
Yeah. He says the fourth generation, but Abraham lived to be 175 years old, so a generation would have been about 400 years at that time. So he's telling him, yes, so I'm going to give you this land, but it's going to be 400 years after you die. So you're not going to be able to occupy the land at all yourself. And not only that, neither is your son or your grandson, but you know, several generations later, your people, after being put in slavery, so again, basically, he's asking to have faith. He's asking to see the things unseen. Yeah. Right? And in Hebrews 11, it says, they did not receive the promise. So Abraham's faith is amazing. Did he waver in his faith occasionally? Yes. Could we say even Hebrews is not totally literal? Yes. But I'd say in the big picture, this guy gets an A plus. An A plus on faith. But partly because God gave him so many assurances. And Genesis 15 is an example of that. All right, Genesis 16 through 18. I only have about 5 minutes to go, but I can do this fairly quickly. So basically then, Sarai offers Hagar, her servant, to Abraham. The code of Hammurabi even said, if a man's wife could not have children, she could give her slave to her husband. The children born from that union would legally be the children not only of the husband, but of the wife who'd given the slave. So she's not being as unselfish as it might seem. Although, you know, the whole marital thing, she was kind of selfish about that, which you can't blame her, because after Hagar started hanging out with Abraham, she kind of didn't like that. All right. But anyway, so basically then, Hagar starts sleeping with Abraham, and Hagar is like younger. Now, at this point, Sarah's probably not quite as beautiful as she was. And Hagar's like, yeah, you know. And so Sarah doesn't like that. She gets really jealous. And she asks Abraham to give the slave back to her, in essence, for her to rule over her. And she treats her very cruelly. And Hagar takes off. She runs away to the desert, where God comes to her and he comforts her. And he says, hey, look, I promise you, God says to Hagar, I promise you, if you'll go back. By this time, she was already pregnant. Says, if you go back, if you give birth to the son, I will bless you and I will turn him into a king. And that is exactly what happens. So Sarai persecutes Hagar. She flees. She goes into the wilderness. God intervenes. It's kind of cool. Let's read Genesis 16, verse 12. Genesis 16, verse 12. He's talking to Hagar about her son Ishmael. And he says, he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility towards all his brothers. Do you know who his descendants are?
We see it today.
The Arab peoples. And, you know, the Arabs and the Jews are not exactly getting along very well right now, even now. So that's kind of interesting.
Never had.
All right.
Never will.
So Hagar flees. God intervenes. He sends her back. Ishmael means God hears. Because while Hagar was basically dying of thirst in the desert, she cried out and God heard, and he gave her a son. Genesis 17, verse 9. That's in my notes, but I'm not even sure what it is, so I better check. Oh, then God said to Abraham, as for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come. All right, anyway. Then Genesis 17. See, I told you. We're going to finish Genesis 17. Pretty good. So Genesis 17 through the middle of 18 is where we see the covenant of circumcision. And by the way, the section we're doing here right now is Hagar and Ishmael, Isaac and Sarah. All right, that's the section here. There's a lot of symbolism. We're not going to have time for that today. But in Genesis 17, we see the covenant of circumcision. And here's where God gives Abram the name Abraham. And he gives Sarai the name Sarah. And in Genesis 17, 15, and 16, he says, Abraham, you idiot. You didn't believe me. I told you. You'd have a child. Abraham says, I did believe you. That's why I had sex with Hagar. And God says, no, that wasn't my plan. Sarah's going to have a child. Sarah was 99 years old. And Abraham goes, well, now he did, you know, it's like he laughed to himself. He's like, okay, God, if you say so. Okay. And guess what his child's name was? He laughs. Yitzhak. Yitzhak Rabin. Wasn't he president of Israel? Yitzhak Rabin. It means he laughs. Rabin. That's his name, is he laughs. Yitzhak. Isaac. The name is Yitzhak. So Genesis 17, verse 12. Every male child must be circumcised on the eighth day. Now, circumcision was an outward sign of an inward grace, just like baptism is an outward sign of an inward grace, right? No, don't go for that one. All right. In fact, it was Ulrich Zwingli was the first one in church history who said baptism in the New Testament, like circumcision in the Old Testament, is an outward sign of an inward grace. Now, is circumcision an outward sign of inward grace? Kind of. Sort of. But didn't Paul say that the only ones who are truly circumcised are the ones who are circumcised in the heart? And baptism is a circumcision of the heart, not of the body. So there is an analogy between circumcision and baptism. Colossians chapter 2 makes the analogy, verse 13 there. And it is true that circumcision is when you became a member of the family of God, and baptism is when... So there is a spiritual analogy, but baptism is no outward sign of an inward grace. I'm out of time here, so I suggest you read Romans 2, 25 through 29, which says the only circumcision that really ever mattered was circumcision of the heart. So Abraham laughs, he's in trouble, but then again, Sarah's going to laugh in Genesis 18. And we've gotten about two-thirds of the way through Abraham, which means we're right on schedule to finish in two more classes. So thank you, and we'll see you next Saturday.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I was wondering how you go from Isaac to Yitzhak, but I can see if you kind of drop some letters there or insert some letters.
Yeah, that is, can you confirm that is the same name, Isaac Yitzhak? Yeah, because in Hebrew it's Yitzhak. I mean, you're reading your Bible, and it says Isaac, but I'm telling you, it's not saying Isaac. It's saying Yitzhak. Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for doing this. It's great.
Come on, stop. Stop you.